Okay, let's do Paul's graph. Paul's graph is, I think, the single, well, there's another case you'll read in civil procedure, familiar with now, but Paul's graph is about the best known case in law school. Generations of law students have suffered through it. You too, well. And we'll talk as we go along about what's important about it, why it's gotten all this attention. But why don't we look at it first here? Who's not had a chance to do one of these cases here? Oh, Mr. Yes, Mr. Pleba, go ahead. Okay, so you got the defendant pushing people onto the train. The train or the passenger that they're helping onto the train has this package that turned out to be fireworks. They fall to the ground, they explode, and Mrs. Paul's graph over here is hit by some baggage scales that drop on her. She wants to recover from the railroad. On what theory?
They were negligent in their medical of the passenger and they were caused for injury.
Okay. So the burden on Mrs. Paul's graph is first to show that they were negligent, that they failed to do something a reasonably prudent person would have done or did something a reasonably prudent person wouldn't have done. And let's assume, for purposes of clarification, that there is some kind of a rule book within the railroad that says if passengers, if the train's already, set for departure and a passenger's trying to get on the train after it's scheduled to leave, you, as a railroad employee, are to encourage them to catch the next train. Do not try to help somebody get on a train about to pull out of the station. So the railroad employee who's doing this is violating a company rule book and would otherwise be failing to use reasonable care. Nonetheless, the defendant says that they're not liable to Mrs. Paul's graph. Why? Okay, now we come to the point where Cardozo, in writing the majority opinion, is actually reverting to Chapter 1. From Cardozo's perspective, this is not a Chapter 1 case. Excuse me, it's not a Chapter 2 case. It's a Chapter 1 case. But the reason it's in Chapter 2 is because Andrews disagrees. And again, one of the reasons why this case attracts so much attention is because most important arguments that people have about important things often revolve around what question you're asking, rather than having different answers to the same question. Sometimes, if you get to decide what the question is, you're pretty much assured that you'll win that argument. But what people wind up arguing over is whether that's the right question to be asking. So Cardozo is asking the question, was the railroad negligent? And Andrews thinks there's a different question we ought to be asking. Now, Cardozo, how does Cardozo reach the conclusion that the railroad wasn't negligent?
Negligence is a relation. It's a two-part relation. Negligence is the railroad's commitment to air, so to speak, and not directly to the air.
And let's pause to digest that for a moment here. Okay, the first thing that you pointed out is that Cardoza says, well, the two things are related. He says it's a mistake to think that something is negligent in itself. Negligent per se? Old Mr. Martin versus Herzog Cardozo? No, there isn't something that is negligent in itself. It's all negligent in relation to somebody. With respect to the passengers they pushed on the train, yes. With respect, let's suppose, for example, that the railroad's employee, in his effort to try to get these people on the train, in effect, launched them into a crowded train car, and these passengers fall all over some other passengers. Let's even suppose they're carrying some fireworks or a chemical or glass that breaks and injures those passengers on the train. Would the defendant railroad be negligent as to them? Okay. How do we know that there's no negligence in relation to Mrs. Paulsgraf? Okay, where's the boundary line between those people as to whom we could be found negligent and those people as to whom we couldn't be found negligent? It's a little bit, it goes a little bit further than the probability of injury. In other words, you sort of a learned hand test. It is, the boundary line is drawn at the point or the area in which negligence can be found is what? What does Cardoza call that? The orbit of duty, or another way of putting it is the zone of danger. Actually, I don't even know if Cardoza uses that phrase. I think he does at some point. Where's that? What page is that on? It's certainly the term that's attributed to him. The orbit of danger, the eye of reasonable vigilance, or the eye of ordinary vigilance. What's that? Does he use the phrase zone of danger?
Orbit
of danger, okay. Again, the visual image here is that there is a point where the eye of ordinary vigilance would anticipate a potential danger. And with respect to those individuals, the defendant has a duty to use reasonable care. But as to people beyond the pale, beyond this orbit of ordinary vigilance, beyond the zone of danger, as to them, there is no negligence because there is no duty of care. I don't have a duty to use reasonable care unless, says Cardozo, I have some reason to think my behavior could be a risk to somebody. As he points out, if I'm walking down the street and there's a pile of newspapers, I'm not going to, you know, carefully step around those newspapers. If I have no reason to think they're other than just a pile of newspapers, I'll just walk right over them. Because I have no reason to think that this is a risk to somebody. If I knew that they had anthrax in them or that they had, you know, some chemical bomb that was about to go, okay, then I would use reasonable care and avoid them. But if I just think they're ordinary newspapers, the reasonable person won't use any care to try to avoid it. So Cardoza says only those people within the zone of danger are owed a duty of care. Those beyond it are not owed a duty of care. If you don't owe a duty of care, you can't be negligent. Next case, please. But, of course, this is not the only view of the case. Andrews, his buddy on the court, takes a different view and asks a different question. He thinks Cardozo is asking the wrong question. What's the question Andrews thinks we should be asking? Okay, and more precisely, did it... Yes, that's his qualification, and one of the reasons for Andrews, including Andrews' opinion here, is that he so clearly differentiates but-for cause from what he calls proximate cause. I would prefer it if he used the term legal cause, but we'll take what we can get here. Okay, so he gives the example of this lantern falling down and causing a big fire, and he says, where is this thing? At the top of page 64, left-hand column, second line. A cause, but not, okay, he says the proximate cause. But not a proximate cause. That's where the emphasis should be on that syllable. Proximate cause is what he's talking about. To say, yes, this thing led in a sequence, but it's not in a natural and unbroken sequence. So again, Andrew says, excuse me, Cardozo, but you know, this action of the defendant's employee was negligent. You would admit it yourself. You say that with respect to these people, it was an act that doesn't reflect reasonable care. In fact, go back to Martin versus, he doesn't make this argument, but we could, go back to Martin versus Herzog. You're saying when the legislature tells you to do something and you don't do it, that is negligence in itself. So the act has a character even before we identify who might be a victim of it. At the same time that they differ in terms of the way they set the problem up, it's not as though Cardozo and Andrews are on completely different planets. They both recognize that there ought to be limits to liability. It's just that the way they draw the line is different. Cardozo purports to do this through the idea of identifying the limits to a duty of care. Andrews, by contrast, identifies the limit in reference to what? What's Andrews' standard again? Cleveland. What's that? Not just those who are in fact injured. It may be the negligence may be a cause of a whole variety of injuries, but only those injuries are entitled to compensation about which we can say that they were proximately caused by the defendant's negligence. Now, if you're kind of intrigued by this approach that Andrews has taken, if it seems to have some logic to it, we want to know more particularly, okay, Andrews, how are you going to draw the line? We know how Cardozo's going to draw the line by figuring out where the eye of reasonable vigilance would stop seeing problems. Where is Andrews going to draw the line? This idea about proximate cause, but tell me some more about how we determine what is or is not proximately caused by this act of negligence. What's Andrew's test for distinguishing the plaintiffs who get compensated from the plaintiffs who don't get compensated? No, again, I think Andrew says direct injury is not enough. Direct in the sense that it's a but-for cause. Or else direct is too limited. That is, the people, you know, if my act directly causes injury, there may be other people. I overserve somebody with alcohol, for example. They get out on the highway and they hurt somebody. I negligently sell fireworks to somebody. He gets on a crowded train. The fireworks blow up. How do I know which defendants are going to be liable for what subsequent injuries that flow from or caused by their negligence? The basic sort of litmus test or the basic faculty that we use to make this distinction is... Mr. Kendall?
It's possible that the argument of policy in that meaning that what was foreseeable, if that was by dropping the dynamite or the fireworks or whatever, that her injury was foreseeable.
Yeah, there were several things that you said there, one of which I want to highlight, which is it's a matter of policy, it's a matter of common sense. Again, one of the reasons why this opinion is widely read and widely assigned is the contrast between the sort of thinking styles, the judicial temperaments of Cardozo on the one hand and Andrews on the other. Cardozo is a much more formalistic person who wants these nice, clear, bright lines, and he, the judge, wants to have firm control of it. Andrews, by contrast, is a little more loosey-goosey here. He's okay with the idea that these are going to be subjective judgments made by juries. Cardozo wants the judge to decide the limits of legal liability. Cardozo wants the jury to decide where the line should be drawn. And he keeps saying such things as, this is on page 64 in the right-hand column, at the end of that paragraph at the top, this is rather rhetoric than law. There is in truth little to guide us other than common sense. And then at the end of the next paragraph, he says, we draw an uncertain and wavering line, but draw it we must as best we can. So Cardozo is trying to tell you there's a science to this, and Andrews is trying to tell you, let's be honest about this. We're simply calling them as we see them. No, there's no shame in that. In fact, there's the virtue of being honest about what we're doing. Now, Andrews, in that same paragraph, this is in the right-hand column on page 64, throws out some hints, as it were, some factors to consider. He says, and I wish he'd use a proximate cause, but hey, we can't be perfect here. A proximate cause, involved as it may be with many other causes, must be, at the least, something without which the event would not happen. Okay, what is that? But for cause. So that's the first prong of our test. But he says, in addition, the court must ask itself whether there was a natural and continuous sequence. Wow, that's the language that shows up in our jury instruction. So the jury instruction seems to be tracking what Andrews is describing as the way we distinguish these things. Was the one a substantial factor in producing the other? And again, he's not prioritizing these or making them a conjunctive test. It's this, 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 and this. He's simply saying, roll these around. Think about them. See where they lead you. Was there a direct connection between them without too many intervening causes? Too many intervening causes. Is the effect of cause on result not too attenuated? Whatever that means. Is there too much between the defendant's original negligence and the ultimate injury to the plaintiff, or we say, wow, we've stretched this thing so far that this thing is beginning to snap or break. Is the cause likely in the usual judgment of mankind to produce the result? I would argue that's the Berry versus Sugar Notch issue. Is this the kind of thing which tends to produce the injury, or are they related in a random fashion, where it's just as likely to produce the opposite effect? It happened in this occasion to produce the effect, but that's not something in our usual experience. Does walking on the side of the road with less traffic increase injuries as compared to walking on the side of traffic facing but much heavier traffic? Or by the exercise of prudent foresight, could the result be foreseen? Now, again, Andrews is not dismissing Cardozo's concern about foreseeability. He's just relegating foreseeability to the status of a factor in a longer list of factors to be considered, rather than saying foreseeability is the be-all and end-all of the limit of a duty of care. Is the result too remote from the cause? And here we consider remoteness in time and space. And here again is the proximate notion that was criticized in Mitchell versus Gonzalez, but Andrews seems to think that the remoteness in time and space does become relevant to the question of whether we can say with a straight face this is a proximate cause of that. And again, he says, at the very bottom of that page, once again, it is all a question of judgment, always keeping in mind the fact that we endeavor to make a rule in each case that will be practical and in keeping with the general experience of mankind. So again, Andrews is pushing away this kind of metaphysical elegance and saying it's a grubby business of trying to come up with a rule that seems to be reasonably practical. So, again, you have this contrast of styles as well as the contrast in, you know, what chapter they locate the problem in. Now, before we get too carried away with this interesting little excursion into sort of the realm of philosophy, the realm of politics, and the realm of, you know, judges and juries and sociology and, you know, all that sort of stuff, don't lose sight of the, well, the practical question of how does this affect your client? Your client, either plaintiff or defendant, may be affected by this argument if your client is involved in a case where between the defendant's negligent act and the ultimate injury to the plaintiff there is this false graphian kind of indirection where you get this, you know, complicated set of intervening forces that make it hard to trace the line between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury, then the defendant will argue either on a Cardozian basis, I didn't owe that plaintiff a duty, or the defendant will argue, maybe I was negligent, but my negligence didn't proximately cause the plaintiff's injury. If the judge thinks there's no duty of care, the judge is going to pull the plug on the case and say, as a matter of law, where there's no duty of care, there can be no negligence. By contrast, if the judge says, well, maybe these guys were negligent, but I'm not sure that this negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury, let the jury wrestle with it, but I'm skeptical. Again, the critical thing here is to be able to identify a typical Paul's graph kind of case. Typical Paul's graph kind of cases, defendant's negligence affects has a sort of primary target. I'm negligent toward these people, but through a screwy set of circumstances, it causes injury to somebody else. There's B over here, Mrs. Paul's grab somebody. Now, one of the exams that I gave raising the Paul's grab issue was defendant's driving down the road in a with an empty flatbed truck. On the flatbed truck is a spare tire. Somehow the spare tire gets loose, bouncing around there in the back of the truck. The spare tire falls off the truck, lands in the middle of the road. Not long thereafter, an ambulance comes around the corner, sees the spare tire in the road, tries to avert the collision with the spare tire, goes into the ditch. Meanwhile, there's a heart attack victim waiting for the ambulance to come and bring medical attention. No medical attention. Plaintiff suffers. Is defendant driving the flatbed truck liable for heart attack victim's injury? What would Cardozo say? Let's make sure we understand the question that Cardozo would ask. Cardozo would ask what question? Then, did they owe a duty? Is the guy driving down the highway, does he owe a duty to this person up, you know, 2 miles away waiting for an ambulance to get there? How would we know whether a duty is owed? What's the question he wants to answer in order to determine whether a duty is owed? Would the eye of reasonable vigilance anticipate a potential danger? If I'm driving down the highway, can I reasonably anticipate that my negligence may prevent an ambulance from getting to its appointed round? If the answer to that question is no, which I'm thinking Cardozo would say is no, well, that person is beyond the eye of reasonable vigilance. I don't owe them a duty. I'm not negligent. How would Andrews, on the other hand, analyze the same problem? What question does Andrews want to ask to decide whether the... Did this negligence, where again, assuming that the driver of this truck is negligent in not securing the tire on the so it doesn't fall off and doesn't land in the highway, is this person liable because this negligence proximately caused the injury? Did it occur in a natural and continuous sequence? Is it the kind of thing which in the experience of mankind leads to that result? Is it not too attenuated in time? All these different things. Is it a substantial factor in play? All these different things that Andrews wants to play with, but ultimately his decision-making fork is a result of this practical policy judgment. It's rhetoric rather than law. Is it fair to make the truck driver responsible for the heart attack victim's injury? And who's going to get to make that call, according to Andrews? A jury. So it's much more likely in an Andrews-type jurisdiction that you're going to be able to play the game. Even though you get to play the game in the Andrews jurisdiction, a jury still has to make that call. A jury still has to say, not only was this guy negligent in allowing the spare tire to bounce off the back of his truck and land in the road and cause somebody else an injury, but it's also a proximate cause of that injury. If the jury can say that, they can impose liability. If they say, well, he was negligent, but I'm sorry, we can't say it's a proximate cause, then you lose. Yes?
Mr. Bovet, right?
Yeah. Why do you think that would be different? I think you're right, it would be different. Why would it be different?
I feel like the tree falling, no matter what he would have done.
Okay, Mr. Ortiz? Why? Why, if you're driving the truck, the ambulance is right behind you, spare tire falls out, hits the ambulance is disabled, can't get to the ambulance victim. It's much more foreseeable if I can see this ambulance in my rearview mirror. If, for example, I there's an ambulance with its sirens and I've got my satellite radio turned up to, 40 decibels, or 200, whatever it is, I've got this music pounding, and I can't hear the siren, and I run into the ambulance. It's much more the whole point of my listening for an ambulance and staying out of the ambulance's way is because the ambulance has got to get someplace. So if the ambulance is in my rearview mirror, and I negligently cause the ambulance to be disabled, then it's much more foreseeable. Whereas if I'm just driving down the highway, and yes, I'm supposed to be careful not to have things fall off my truck and hurt people, but I have no reason to think that an ambulance, as distinguished from somebody else on the road, is going to be the victim of my negligence. It's much harder for me to foresee the consequence that results. Notice, too, the big difference between the ambulance driver. If the ambulance driver is negligent in not seeing this tire in the middle of the road, you're supposed to drive in such a way that you're not, unable to avoid obstacles in the middle of the road. If the ambulance driver was negligent in failing to avoid the collision with the spare tire, is the ambulance driver liable for the injury to the heart attack victim? Yeah, that's an easy case. What are you doing if you're driving an ambulance except trying to use reasonable care to get someplace on time so you can rescue people who need your help? As to the ambulance driver, there's no foreseeability problem at all. It's not a problem for Cardozo. It's not a problem for Andrews. It's only with respect to this remote defendant whose negligence sets up the problem, but as to whom it's much harder to say, oh, that defendant should have foreseen this consequence and should have used reasonable care to avoid it. Maybe I'm negligent for not securing my spare tire, but the reason I would be negligent is not because I'm afraid I'm going to hit ambulances on their way to save heart attack victims. That's not very foreseeable. So again, you want to be able to spot these kind of foreseeability issues where the defendant's negligence sets off a chain of events, but it takes a couple of bounces before it finally hurts the plaintiff, as distinguished from those people that are essentially right on top of the situation. Negligence more or less directly causes injury to plaintiff. While you're soaking all this in, let me again contrast this with the superseding cause issue. They're related because they both have to do with legal cause, but a superseding cause is one gigantic event. It's a, car theft, or it's a murder, or it's some other kind of dramatic superseding event. Paul's graph is more of these sort of little causes along the way, that one thing bumps into another thing. That's why we segue from here into the Buffalo River. Take a little swim in the Buffalo River in Kinsman Transit here, because Kinsman Transit is an example of how you can apply either a Cardozian or an Andrewsian methodology in evaluating which defendants are on the hook for which kinds of injuries. Before we get to Kinsman Transit, is there anything else we need to address in Paul's draft?
Just that.
Mr. Garcia.
Hymas,
I'm sorry.
I don't have mic. Does Andrews, when using the idea of fairness as a proximate cause to arrive at the verdict, does he use it almost as a form of strict liability or...
Well, not, but I think you're on the right track in the sense that what Andrews is doing is making a policy judgment about expanding liability in favor of the plaintiff, whereas, again, Cardozo's impulse is to kind of restrict liability in favor of a defendant. So in the same way that, for example, deciding the boundaries of an abnormally dangerous activity, we're deciding who bears the risk. How wide are we going to extend the net of liability? Who's going to escape? And who's going to get caught? Andrews has a more sort of plaintiff-friendly attitude, which is, let the jury decide how far we're going to extend liability. A defendant who acts negligently, according to Andrews, should be prepared for as much liability as the jury thinks is fair to extend upon that defendant. Whereas again, Cardozo was saying, I, the judge, have to be careful not to let those juries get their bloody little mitts on the issues here, because Lord only knows what they'll do with them. So, again, you have this sort of contrast of temperaments and styles, which may be reflected again in the attitude of the judges who decide to either extend liability or restrict it. And I would say, just sort of from a sociological perspective, that in Cardozo's day, judges were more restrictive. I think I've said this before, that in reference to Martin versus Herzog, the kinds of people who became judges tended to be a more sort of upper crust conservative lot. Whereas I think today that's not as true as it once was. If anything, the judiciary tends to be more sort of the intellectually adventurous, less conservative. And so you, at least, you know, for every conservative impulse that a judge has that's restrictive relative to the more liberal populace, you have judges who are liberal in areas where the populace left to their own devices would be more conservative. So it's a more of a kind of mixed bag today than it was, the sort of stark sociological contrast that you see in Cardozo's deck. Hence, defendants today often want juries. There are many insurance companies who want juries rather than judges deciding cases, because they think juries are going to be more likely to be defendant-friendly than judges. So, again, the sort of sociology has changed around. Okay, let's talk to... We can't really get very far, but I want to just sort of paint the picture here on Kinsman Transit so we can pick up there tomorrow. Sounds much better on a hot summer day than in the dead of winter to contemplate this particular case. There are two defendants in Kinsman Transit that we concern ourselves with. One is the owner of this Continental dock. And their job is to tie up these big, heavily laden vessels. I forget what they're transporting. Grain. Loaded with grain. And the Shiras is tied up here at this dock. Whoever's in charge of this doesn't do a very good job. They're negligent. And there are all these, you know, nautical references here about what they're supposed to have done that they didn't do. But the bottom line is that this thing gets loose and starts floating merrily down the stream. In turn, there's another vessel out here. I think it's the Tewksbury that it bumps into. Somebody along the way sees this all happening, picks up the phone, and calls ahead, knowing that there's a bridge downstream owned by the city of Buffalo. But meanwhile, there's this really good hockey game on TV at the local tavern, and the guy who's operating the bridge runs down to the he's gone off shift, or maybe it's the new guy who's supposed to, his shift starts at 8, but he's going to stay and watch the end of this hockey game before he goes back to his boring old job raising the bridge. And maybe when he gets there, some people are going to be honking their horns because he's a little bit late, but they can just wait. Now, these vessels float down the stream and run up against the bridge, and instead of just bashing into it, damaging them and or the bridge, they find themselves wedged against the bridge, forming a kind of dam. And coupled with the ice floating in the Buffalo River at this time of year, it forms an effective dam. The water backs up, eventually actually causes the collapse of the bridge, as well as flooding damage to the people that live along the Buffalo River. Now, the question before the House is, what should be the liability of the dock owner, the people who are supposed to be tying these boats securely so they don't go floating down the stream, and the liability of the city of Buffalo? And the reason for this case is a kind of, you know, analytical place to sharpen our tools, is because there are obviously some plaintiffs in this case who have a very easy time establishing not only negligence, but the right to compensation, because that negligence proximately caused their injury. There are other plaintiffs to whom we would say, well, your injury may have been caused in some sense by the defendant's negligence, but you don't get to recover. And so what we want to do is ask, what is Cardozo's perspective? If Cardozo were in charge of this, how would he analyze it? And by contrast, if Andrews is in charge of it, how would he analyze it? And what we should do is basically, let's start with that tomorrow and look at the competing opinions. We'll touch briefly on some of the notes here. I do need to refer you to the notes that follow Kinsman Transit and then this last case of Harris versus R.A. Martin. Then we'll start in on Chapter 3. So, this being Monday, we will be starting Chapter 3 on Tuesday. We'll get as far as we can by Friday. I'm guessing we'll probably make it to the beginnings of wrongful death or shortly thereafter. We'll see how it goes. Okay, what I have now is I have the exams to hand out. I'm going to do them in numerical order. I'll make just one last comment. This is for those of you who've read John Rawls' A Theory of Justice. This is Behind the Veil of Ignorance. And in Rawls gives you this thought experiment in which you are to imagine yourself picking a set of rules to govern life when you are born into this world. And he says, what would a rational person choose by way of rules of social distribution? And he's saying that the positions we now have about social justice, whether, the rich should be required to redistribute their wealth to the poor, is in part a function of the position that we hold. If we're rich, we're against it. If we're poor, we're for it. But he says, what would a rational person, not knowing their situation, pick by way of rules of social distribution? And he builds a whole book, A Theory of Justice, on this thought experiment. So I think of us being here behind the veil of ignorance before you get your first grades in law school, having your own ideas about whether grades are this perfect reflection of your ability and prospects in life, or whether they're a random, if anything, perverse reflection. But that moment is about to pass here, and you'll be on the other side of the veil of ignorance. Now, again, what I've done here, there is a sheet of comments, and there is a checklist, and on the checklist you have a number. That number reflects a GPA times 10. So if, let's say, it's a 28, that's a 2.8, that's a B-, slightly better than that. When Susan was talking about those with a 2.2 or above, that would be, again, I would call it a 22, but for your purposes, stick a decimal point in it, and it's slightly below a C-plus there. So, again, do that accordingly. And here she is. Okay. So, actually, now we have two different numbering systems here. If you can remember the number that you used. Actually, Susan, why don't I give you...
The exam soft or the written one?
I'm going to give you, actually, from... These are the numbers... from 5 and above. So if you had a 5-digit number, a 4-digit number, it's the number you started with. I used the first 4 digits for purposes of arranging them in order. So if your number was, say, 20652 or 2168, you'd be in my part of the... she's from 5,000 and above. I'm from 0 to 4999. So come to me, all you who... labor and are heavy laden.
Okay, let me turn this off first.